Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's a Monday afternoon. Welcome to the afternoon and the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand here. Nice to be back after a week away. Boy, we had a great time with a number of WGN listeners on a tour of England. I hope to talk about that a little bit later in the program if we have time. Thanks to John Hansen, Terry Savage, Elise Glink, I think, filled in as well, and Amy Guth while I was gone. So I appreciate that. And I'm glad you're here on this Monday afternoon. In the studio are Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis from Chicago Inno. They join us on most Mondays to talk about what's what. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, Steve.
Well, the news today, right, is about Sears, and Sears certainly isn't a tech startup, but it was a Chicago institution. You know, it was an institution really in a lot of people of my generation, their lives. That's what we... That's where we shopped, and now they're filing for Chapter 11. And Dahlke, you were talking about a couple of ideas that, you know, they've sort of, to me, been doomed for a long time, but maybe they'd taken a different track a while ago. Things might be different.
Yeah, you know, Sears kind of was, you know, the Amazon before the internet, you know.
Yeah, really? I mean, you used to order a house from your Sears catalog.
And everybody kind of talks about how they kind of missed digital and they missed e-commerce as Amazon was sort of rocketing, you know, becoming the rocket ship that it is. But kind of what's more interesting to me is sort of how, not they didn't become Amazon, but how Sears didn't become Walmart or Target or one of these other kind of large retailers, because both Walmart and Target really did embrace digital. And you really have seen not only them, you know, unveil digital products of their own, but invest in startups and invest in ecosystems across the country.
Well, that's what interests me, right? So anyone can say, yeah, we're going to sell our stuff online, and Sears did that, and they might not have done it very well. But you're talking about something different than that.
So basically what you know, Walmart has done to Bentonville, Arkansas, its headquarters, has turned that little town in Arkansas into a tech hub. It's what Target has done to the Twin Cities. You know, Target has four tech accelerators in the Twin Cities where companies from all across the country go to build their tech businesses. It's built up. It helped build up a tech ecosystem there. I mean, think about what Sears could have done if it had sort of embraced digital and technology earlier to help build the e-commerce ecosystem here in Chicago.
So identify other sort of companies, maybe pick them up and expand with them.
Exactly. Whether it's acquiring them or buying their software.
We talk about Tyson, right? Tyson has an accelerator. Is it here in Chicago?
That's right.
Same
they have,
sort of thing.
They have an accelerator and a fund. So not only are they helping incubate businesses, but they're, you know, funding them as well. And they've done that to a handful of companies around town.
Catherine Davis had a sit down with Mayor Emanuel as the mayor moves into his final months in office. And, you know, I think he'll be remembered, for some negative things. But when it comes to the world of tech and startups in Chicago, certainly, he's got a nice record, and I'm sure he was more than happy to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I sat down with Rahm a couple weeks ago at the Chicago Venture Summit, you know, and there he was kind of talking about his tenure and what his administration has done for the tech ecosystem. You know, he was a big supporter of 1871 opening up back in 2012. He's been at several ribbon-cutting ceremonies for Chicago tech offices that have opened here. And, you know, he's had other initiatives like Chicago Next to just kind of raise Chicago's profile as a tech hub in general.
I know former Mayor Daley listens to the show every day because he loves the Wintrust Business Minute. But if he's listening right now, you know, he'll be saying, hey, I did a lot of this stuff too, right? A lot of it predates Emanuel, but Emanuel, forgive the term, accelerated it. I mean, is that fair to say?
I think so. You know, I think we saw a big increase in the number of tech jobs here, especially with, you know, how he worked with big corporations to move their headquarters to Chicago from the suburbs.
Right, right.
That's the thing he gets credited with a lot.
Well, that depends on who you ask, too, because he's a guy who lives in the suburbs and I live in Deerfield, and they have a number of companies that have relocated out of the city. You know, it's good for the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so good for me.
You know, one thing that he did, too, is he just kind of helped raise the profile of some of the things that were happening, right? So he was regularly at 1871, helped kind of get that off the ground. And 1871, you know, not only was a place or is a place for digital startups to work, but it really was a place for people from out of town to come see Chicago. It was really the first entrance that a lot of out-of-town venture capitalists and other business folks got to see of Chicago's tech ecosystem. And Ron was a big champion and is a big champion of that.
Catherine, he cut a lot of ribbons, didn't he?
He sure did.
He showed up, and we'd get the mayor's schedule, and he was always cutting a ribbon or announcing it could be 60 jobs or, you know, something like that. He was there, especially when it comes to tech.
Right.
So one of the big projects he's announced and is behind is this the Boring Company, the Elon Musk company that's going to dig a hole to O'Hare Airport, mm-hmm. which seems to me to might be at risk now. What did he say about that?
You know, he said that he's not too worried about it. You know, I kind of brought up Elon Musk's, you know, current issues with kind of his erratic public behavior, his tweets, being sued by the SEC. And he's like, you know, well, I think Elon has a lot to prove, but what better way to do it than to build this great new transit system in Chicago?
And about the Amazon headquarters announcement, does he think that his departure will have much of an impact there?
No, he said he doesn't, mainly because he thinks that Chicago's strengths of the tech hub can speak for themselves. You know, depending on who's mayor, that will always be changing. But with the, you know, the accelerators we have here, the capital that's coming here, he thinks that Chicago will be able to.
I know in the story you wrote, it's a nice piece. You talked to others like Howard Tolman from 1871 mm-hmm. and others about who comes next. Are they worried about, because, you know, for some of this stuff, or I think for the Boring Company plan, you've got to have some clout coming in, some political capital, and a new mayor is not going to have some of that capital. I mean, is the tech world worried about that?
I think so. I mean, Howard was talking to me about how, you know, he's just kind of anxious to see if our next mayor is going to be as business friendly, as tech friendly. Is this going to be someone who, you know, knows how to, you know, talk to and attract CEOs,
right.
businesses, et cetera. So we'll see.
You put in the piece the fact that the mayor's criticized for maybe spending more money downtown than in in the neighborhoods, and that's the sort of struggle we'll see. So check that out at Chicago Inno, Catherine's interview with Mayor Emanuel. Jim, you were telling me about a cool story about the Northwestern punter who came through, won the game against Nebraska over the weekend.
Yeah, it was the kicker, Drew. Luckenbaugh, I think is how you pronounce his last name. And yeah, he's, you know, a sophomore. He got his first action of the year, and he kicked the game-winning field goal against Nebraska, and then in his post-game press conference talked about how at Northwestern he's constantly in the garage, which is Northwestern's kind of on-campus co-working tech hub for students, where he's working on an app called BarTap.
And what is BarTap, too?
BarTap essentially basically is a way to sort of order your beer from your phone when you're at the bar, so maybe kind of making the process of getting your beer a little more efficient.
Okay, so let me get this straight. You kick the game-winning field goal, and then you make it easier for the students to get a beer afterward?
Exactly.
And he's a pretty popular guy, I would think.
What better way to kind of promote your app than after you just kick the game-winning field goal, right? So yeah, he's got definitely a marketing future.
Tell me about, I'm interested in the story about Nexus AI and how they're now using artificial intelligence to decide which projects I should be working on at work. Who's going to take that for me?
Sure, I can tell you a little bit about Nexus AI. So this is a startup in Chicago, kind of started from this entrepreneur's previous business called Concept Drop. And the whole idea behind that was to kind of connect freelance marketers, freelance creative folks with businesses who are in need of different design projects. So what they kind of found was they had this really interesting algorithm that matched people who were very qualified for certain projects with businesses who needed those projects done. They found that that same algorithm works within an internal company. So think about a company with 5,000, 10,000
right,
employees.
Right.
As you're putting teams together to work on certain projects, you want to assemble the best teams who are going to do that project the best. And what they have figured out is they have an algorithm that can match the best people in your company for a specific project.
So if it's a project manager, say WGN Radio or Chicago Inno, maybe not so much because the employee base is more limited and you probably have a better independent knowledge of those employees. We're talking about companies with thousands of people.
Think about, you know, an international business. You have offices all across the country and the world, and you're going to have people work on different projects, and they might be in different locations. They may have different skill sets. So this tech company kind of takes into account all of these different variables and really assembles the team that's going to be best equipped to handle that project.
And where are they now?
So right now they are kind of still in the early stages. They do have clients, so they are working with some businesses. They have one firm that has about 5,000 employees, so they are kind of actively deploying their tech. And so right now they're kind of working on two sides of the business. The concept drop side is still alive as well, so they're kind of having these two sort of separate entities kind of working side by side.
Catherine, you wrote a story about this company Coderspace about, and this is about getting women more involved in writing code?
Yeah, women and minorities. So Aurelia Jones, she's a Chicago-based tech worker. She's at Sprout Social. They make a social media management platform. And she founded Coderspace on Chicago Southside. Actually, they operate out of the University of Chicago. And they offer free courses, coding courses for high school students in the area. And so, you know, teaching them how to design websites. And then they do some client work for local businesses. And at the end of every cohort, all the students get a free device so that they can continue you know, practice their newly founded coding skills.
You know, I had on someone from the Roberti Culinary Institute a couple of weeks ago, and there are a number of now companies that are training people to work in the restaurant business because it's an entry-level job and the restaurants need workers and sort of things like that. This isn't the same as that, but it reminds me, in a way, to providing opportunity to people who might not have had it otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, you know, more and more schools are trying to incorporate coding and, you know, STEM resources into the curriculum, but not all of them do. So this is kind of a good way to supplement that and to ensure that, you know, students from all backgrounds can kind of get this coaching that they need to compete in today's economy.
All right, before we're done here, I want to talk about G2 Crowd because we've talked to them, and we certainly talk about them a lot. That's sort of a place where if you're interested in a piece of business software, you can go and get a review on it one way or another. Now that, Jim, you write they want to start selling software?
Exactly. So they were the Yelp for business software. Now they're kind of the Amazon or the Kayak, right? A place where you can actually not just see reviews, but actually make a purchase. So it's a pretty big business evolution for them. And, you know, G2 Crowd just raised $55 million. They've raised $100 overall. And really their goal is not to sell the business. They say they want to be public. They want to do an IPO.
Yeah.
So it's pretty rare, actually, kind of from a venture-backed startup perspective in Chicago. We've seen some biotech IPOs, but not a lot of the kind of the digital startup, you know, locally grown, venture-backed, turned public company.
So if they, I'm thinking of, and Yelp never got, they started delivering food, right? But it never really kind of took over their business.
But they did a similar evolution, right? So the review is still a huge part of Yelp, but they did kind of create a delivery mechanism within their business too, right? So I think G2 Crowd even sees this, but even, you know, as crowded as food delivery is, they think they're really positioned to kind of be the marketplace for not only reviews of software, but to purchase them as well.
Was it the grand plan all along? I mean, if it was devilish, right? Because you build this great reputation, come here to learn about software. People are doing it now, and all of a sudden, you can buy it there.
There's an old Silicon Valley reference. URL stands for users first, revenue later. And I think a lot of Silicon Valley companies did this, and I think G2 Crowd has done it sort of similarly, right? They've created a platform where they get thousands and thousands of users, and now they're going to have a place to turn those users into to purchasers.
Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis from Chicago Window, thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Thanks very much for tuning in. And on the phone line now is Mike Capone, the CEO of Click. Mike, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be here.
You know, I got to tell you, people are always a little concerned when they hear someone named Capone on the radio in Chicago. So you're prepared for that, I would think.
I'm completely prepared. It was a dual-use trip. I got to keynote the event, and I got to visit some relatives while I was out there.
Is that really true? Did you visit relatives?
My brother actually lives out in Chicago, and on his business card, it actually says, yes, I'm related.
Well, that's good if you have a sense of humor about it. You were here for this Data Revolution Tour put on by Click. So let's just start with Click. What is it that you do?
At Click, we are a third-generation business intelligence tool. Our goal is actually to help not only our clients, but actually the world become a better place, leveraging data everywhere in every possible decision, strategic and operational, across the board.
How do you find that sort of the data intelligence when it comes to business owners around the country, and I guess in Chicago in particular?
it's obviously a hot topic. And, you know, Steve, analytics has been around a long time, but traditionally it's been sort of backwards looking, analyzing information that you sort of already knew about. But with the advances in computing power, with the advances in just software in general, and then the layering in of artificial intelligence and machine learning, we've opened up a whole new set of possibilities. And then, as you know, the amount of data coming at these businesses is tremendous. And, you know, I think for the first time, we actually have the power to harness that data and build predictive models to actually have people run their businesses in a much smarter, intelligent way.
So, in other words, if you used to sell candy bars, you could look back at your past month and see which candy bars sold well on which days and which didn't, that sort of data. What you're talking about now is using deeper data to actually predict future activities.
That's exactly right. You know, think of it as a car. You know, you drive a car, very often analytics was looking in the rearview mirror, what happened last month, last quarter, last year, and then we got smart and built dashboards. So visualizations and dashboards were hot for a while, but that still shows you what's happening now. The way to really gain competitive advantage is actually to be able to look forward, and that's where these new this new generation of tools is able to harness information, and again, with modern techniques and the advent of artificial intelligence, you can actually start building predictive models and reinvent your future.
Well, give me an example. What are we talking about? I mean, can you give me the story of one business that does well or doesn't do well, something like that?
Yeah, you know, I'll give you a couple local examples. You know, we were in Chicago for a reason. It's actually a great market and some really awesome customers out there. One company out in Chicago, Sunstar, uses our technology to empower their sales teams to be able to predict what client needs are going to be in the future, and then walk into meetings with customers and actually demonstrate to them what their demand is going to be and how they can actually get into new markets and drive competitive advantage. The second I'll give you is AbbVie, which is also a very well-known company outside of Chicago, and we work with them in a very similar fashion. As you can imagine, sales forecasting in the pharmaceutical world is a fairly complex process, and they're able to leverage very large data sets to make smart decisions.
I'm just back from a trip to Europe. I took a group of WG listeners, and, you know, we tend in the States to, I think, incorrectly, ignorantly maybe, think that we are always leading the way on issues like this. And, you know, you when you go to other countries, you realize that no, they're pretty advanced as well. I mean, how does a typical U.S. business compare around the world? Are we leading the way here? Are we trailing? Do we need to speed up? Or what's the situation there?
You know, so Qlik was founded in Sweden, so we're actually an incredibly global business, and more of our business comes from outside the U.S. than inside of it, so I get great insight into that. You know, the U.S. leads the way in terms of technological innovation. I think that's clear, but, you know, there's this concept of data literacy, which is actually the ability of people to, you know, read, understand, argue with, and make decisions based on data. And you know what? The U.S. doesn't lead the way. You have countries like Singapore, who actually are incredibly data literate and are leveraging data in much greater ways. Only about a third of executives in the U.S. Consider themselves to be data literate. So it's not just a technology discussion. There's this concept of making people more comfortable using data versus gut feel to actually make smarter decisions. And, you know, at Qlik, we have this data literacy program that we just launched with companies like Accenture and Cognizant, where we're working not only to deliver technology, but actually to improve data literacy around the world.
It's kind of interesting because the people you're probably trying to sell on this idea are people who've achieved their success by relying on their gut, right? So it might be a little counterintuitive for them that you would have some convincing to do.
It's very counterintuitive, you know, but some of those same people are the ones who were standing up brick and mortar stores and didn't see Amazon coming, right?
So right.
The world is changing, and the companies that learn to leverage data in a more powerful way are the ones that are going to succeed and thrive in the coming world.
You know, the vast majority of the listeners to us right now are not CEOs or running a company. They're the people whose data is being collected. And I would imagine when you're collecting data, there has to be, I mean, there needs to be some sort of sensitivity there as well, right? It's important for business, but you don't want to be seen as being too intrusive either.
That's exactly exactly right, Stephen. You know, I spent 26 years at a little company called ADP, which is the world's largest payroll outsourcing provider. So we had an awesome responsibility about the data we held. And it is a conversation that we at Qlik take very seriously, and we also have the conversation with our customers. It's not just about respecting legislative boundaries, because quite frankly, the technology and the collection of data is outpacing the legal environment, the legislative ability to keep up with it. So we actually feel like we have a moral obligation to treat that data correctly, to be transparent about what we're doing, and you know, where appropriate, to actually make sure we have the right consent to use information.
Mike Capone is the CEO of Qlik, and I should say it's spelled Q-L-I-K. Now, listen, great to talk to you. We'll tell the family you said hello.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a great day.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Good news, your tickets for the upcoming show at the Lyric Opera aren't going to be void anymore. The Chicago Federation of Musicians Local Number 10-208 settled their strike focusing on pay raises. It's a contract deal that's set through the 2020 and 2021 Lyric Opera season, and thankfully only a handful of performances were canceled from over the weekend. And now we can head back over and get our opera fix.
Figaro, Figaro, Figaro.
Hey, cut that out. But if that doesn't satisfy your craving, chances are you'll find something along your likings at Chicago Ideas Week. The annual event is underway until Sunday, the 21st. In the span of just 1 week, there's nearly 300 speakers with 200 plus events to attend and learn about everything from pizza advocacy to the worst case scenario if hackers took over the country. Most events are free, but for some of the higher profile speakers, tickets are roughly $15 a piece and happening all around the city. So take a look. You might like what you see on their website, chicagoideas.com. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Well, tomorrow is National Bosses Day. Did you know that? I don't know that you buy a flower or chocolate, or what do you do for National Bosses Day? I'm just going to show up and do my job. I don't know about Marilyn Bird, who's on a phone line now. Marilyn, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Marilyn is the district president of Robert Half, and we've talked a few times, Marilyn. And tell me about, you know, here we are in this very hot jobs market. I would imagine that bosses are more important than ever when it comes to retaining talent. You know, businesses being afraid of losing talent. If you don't like your boss, that's a pretty good reason to leave.
Well said. There's a lot of research, including this survey, that confirms exactly that. Bosses have a significant impact on job satisfaction, office morale, the overall environment, and just how people feel on a daily basis.
And this national survey done by Office Team, I was surprised to see that 80% of those surveyed nationally are happy with their bosses. I think 80% is a pretty high number.
I think it is, too. I'm like you. I was glad to see it, to see Chicago on the positive, the positive as well. But it is interesting that it's so high.
Why do you think it is? Is it just because times are good? I mean, what do you attribute it to?
The survey did not get into the details of why, but what it did talk about is that people feel good about their manager if it's a good leader.
Mm-hmm.
It pointed out mentorship. It pointed out friendship.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Those were the three areas. I thought that was a very interesting take on what a supervisor is.
So I had the national number in front of me, but the national number for, here it is, workers who consider their boss their friend is 34%. It is highest, I think, in L.A. at 52%. You're in the staffing business, and you look at this. Is friendship something that bosses should aspire to when it comes to their workers?
I think it's an interesting word, you know, friendship. I don't know that that's a word that I would use to describe it, but what it's really getting at is there a personal connection?
Right.
Is there a personal connection between the leader and the team? And there's a lot of reasons to put energy behind that. That definitely goes a long way.
You know, I like your analysis of that, because you're right. Friendship probably maybe isn't, maybe it's the best word for what we're talking about, but maybe not a perfect word. Nationally, 80% of people like their bosses. And Chicago, it's even higher?
Chicago's one of the top cities, believe it or not. Top five.
Wow.
That came out with the highest rates.
What's our number?
You know what? Let me. I don't know that I have the specific number.
No, I have it. It's 85%. 85%.
So much positive here. I was glad to see us on the top of a good list.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because we have so many complaints about institutions in the city, whether it's, you know, government or what have you. So I just tend to think that we are in a position where we tend to complain about authority. So, yeah, I was surprised by that number, 85% as well.
It made me think of a survey that's unrelated, but it was a survey of approximately the same number of professionals recently that came out, and it was about work-life balance.
Uh-huh.
Chicago ranked really highly in their rankings on that scale as well. I'm not suggesting they're related, but it is interesting to see both of those things come out in recent data.
Well,
and those are very high priorities for employees today.
I'm not an expert in any way, so I will say that they probably are related. I mean, if you have a nice work-life balance, then it's much easier to enjoy your job than if you don't. So Illinois or Chicago does well. Indianapolis, so is the ranking were Indianapolis, Salt Lake City, Chicago, L.A., and then Miami in the top five. Where are the workers least happy?
For this survey, it came out in Boston, Phoenix, D.C., Cincinnati and Detroit.
Any idea why that might be?
It didn't get into the specifics on that.
Right.
I can only imagine that it's coming from the rankings on that prior leadership, friendship, mentorship.
Yeah, okay. Well, so it's nice to be here in Chicago where we are perfectly happy to, well, I would say let's extend our lunch by half an hour or an hour or so because we love our job so much. Our bosses are our friends. They really won't mind.
I don't know that that's the case. I'm not sure that we can make that inference.
Let's push it a little bit. Marilyn Bird is the district president of Robert Half. Great to talk to you.
Thanks again, Steve.